name of this poem is The Death of the Bald Colonel. From my mother's sleep, I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from earth, loosed from its dream of life, I woke to black flak and the nightmare fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the tournament with a hose. And in those sidelines, of course, he evokes just the carnage and the brutality and the impersonality of conflict. And we could get stuck on that. And as I say, regardless of the person's position, we can just simply visualize this in our mind's eye, and we know that there is something morally wrong, something at least that points towards evil in a world that brings these things about. But yet, it's a more subtle problem, a more general problem than that. Even more subtle and more general than the terrific emotion that's evoked in us by these movies, for example, about the concentration camp. Here's a couple of little poems by Howard Nemiroff, which brings the subtlety out that I want to talk about today. They're both about education, and I suppose it's because I've been involved with education all my life, for the most part, that I see it this way. Probably a lawyer, a physician, or someone else in another profession might see it through their eyes, but this seems to me to bring out some of the subtlety of the problem of evil in our day. This is called To David, a little boy, about his education. The world is full of mostly invisible things, but there is no way but putting out the mind's eye, or its nose, in a book, to find them out. Things like the square root of Everest, or how many times Byron got into Texas, or whether the law of the excluded middle applies west of the Rockies. For these and like reasons, you have to go to school, and study books, and listen to what you're told, and sometimes try to remember them. Though I don't know what you will do with the mean annual rainfall on Plato's Republic, or the caloric content of the diet of worms, such things have said it'd be good for you, and you will have to learn them in order to become one of the grown-ups. Now, then he answers the question, what is a grown-up? Who sees invisible things neither steadily nor whole, but keeps gravely the grand confusion of the world under his path, which is where it belongs, and teaches small children to do the same in their turn. Some of the subtlety of the evil, maybe. These invisible things, you know, they can't be expressed, but ought to be kept under our hat. Problem of evil may be a pseudo problem, and a great many modern philosophers believe it is. In fact, they believe most problems are pseudo problems. They're hung up on the idea that if we could just get clear what each word meant and string all of these defined words together and in strictly, you know, construed sentences, all the problems would disappear. Unfortunately, after we've done that, we still find that we're hungry, cold, naked, thirsty, and some of us are some of the time, and we still have marital problems, and we wonder what has happened to the enlightenment which was to come when we would get things clear. This is a good way, you know, of being respectable and still keeping invisible things confusedly and yet safely under our hat. But there's a second way, it's sort of an opposite error. Of course, it seems you don't have to be a gay in believing things go like this, you know, steadily one and then the opposite and then some sort of triumph, to see that there are equal and opposite errors in life, apparently. The opposite error is what Nemiroff sings about in The Triumph of Education. And whereas the first was the kind of education I suppose you and I had, we had to learn facts, and the grand confusion about invisible things was kept safely under everybody's hat, this might be the kind of education I feel sometimes our children may be getting, and we have to wonder whether it's good. He says, the children's eyes were like lakes of the sea, baffling with their false serenity when they were told and given all the cause, quote, there is no Santa Claus. The children's eyes did not become more bright or curious of sexual delight when someone said, quote, man couples like the beast, the stork does not exist. The children's eyes, like smoke or drifted snow, white shifted over white, refused to show they suffered loss. Quote, at first it may seem odd, but there isn't any God. The children, not perturbed nor comforted, heard silently the news of their last bed. Quote, for moral care you need not stint your breath. There is no life after death. The children's eyes grew hot, they glowed like stoves, ambitious and equipped with all our proofs. They ran forth, little women, little men, and were not children then. And so the triumph of education, in a way that symbolizes the subtlety of this problem, or whatever it is, a group perhaps of some real and some imaginary problems that we would call evil. The fertility of things. That there is a grand confusion under everybody's hat, even the hat of those who talk about the problem, maybe, and offer some solution. I think one of the things that may have confused you the other morning was the use of terms. And of course, it's always difficult to say when you're using terms that you've been using a long time, well, where do you have to define a term? And I would like that you could ask me to define any term that is not immediately clear to you. I would also have to say probably all the terms I use and not use in the sense that you use them, and so they really all need definition. But some terms are a little more foreign than others, such as Latin, the usage in certain professions. By evil, we mean that grand confusion about the state of things that characterizes all of us, from the simplest to the most complex personalities, and from the least to the supposedly best educated. When we're faced with events, we're faced with decisions and choices in life that seem insoluble to us. For example, when we're faced with the suffering of a little child, or when we're faced with what, although we might not have recognized it at the time, when we reflect upon it, we see was an almost insane thing for intelligent men to do. Perhaps all wars are seen this way after the fact. Perhaps most fights between people. Perhaps a lot of other things that are done. Maybe the results of certain elections. We might look back and say, where was logic and common sense and goodwill there then? They were faced with this insoluble, this intangible, this confused mass in our minds, something that Nemiroff wrote about in his first poem. But there's something more subtle, too, than that. And I think that the second poem illustrates it. And that is, and I'm going strictly now, logically, on the premise that we first introduced Monday morning together, that man is a creature who seeks after meaning in life. And this not only has something to say specifically about man as an animal, man as a creature, man as a portion of the world, but it has something to say about man's religion, because a man's religion, at base, ultimately, when he stops and thinks about it, is part of his quest for meaning. It is out of this that he either receives some information or entertains some hopes that he will find meaning, or perhaps he confesses in faith that he has found meaning for his life. Now, that meaning tends to get outflanked by events. And there's where the real problem comes. And again, following from a second proposition that I put to you the other morning, that this problem, come here, Paulie, come on, sit down. This problem becomes increasingly important as you move into the sphere of religion as we know it in the West, among Jews and Christians, where there is a firm, a basic principle whose nature is goodness. In other words, ethical monotheism as we know it from the Bible and Old Testament. This question of the confusion that strikes us, not just in the midst of particular events, you know, such as the ball current dinner or the concentration camp or a senseless murder or something of this nature, but more than that strikes us when we reflect back upon events that we may not have recognized at the time we underwent them were, to put it in a word, meaningless or positively vicious in their upshot. Even great crusades, which may have at least partially caught us up, and we would have thought that somehow good was going to come, and sometimes we're even aware of it, out of less than good means or evil means of greater good will come, and then we reflect back upon it, and we look and we see. In common parlance, we look and we see the first great war was not, you know, the war to end all wars, nor to make democracy stable. The second war was anything but that, but was apparently the brooder for many, many other wars and many, many other realities for war. And then when we look upon this, this must have something to say about this meaningfulness. And last analysis, and I said this toward the end of that hour, if we are religiously inclined, and significantly, if we're religiously committed, intellectually and spiritually committed to Christianity or Judaism, this ultimately has got to have something to say about the doctrine of God. For God is the doctrine of meaning in our tradition. This is his function, if you will, and I'm not talking now about redeeming and creating and saving, but I'm talking about God, logically speaking, and even psychologically speaking, as he functions in our thought and in our planning and our actions in the world. This has got to say something. It's got to bring up a question to us. I'm not saying that it has to be an irresolvable question. It doesn't mean you have to stop believing in God. It does mean that you have to be concerned. It means that you have to take the risk that you will lose something. It takes the risk that you will be able to grow, perhaps. Take the risk that you might be able to clarify something. That in a way, it means that some of the mystery of God will, I suppose there's at least two things that could happen and you would stay with the belief in God. One, that it becomes more mysterious than ever, which I think is too simple a solution. We ought not to settle for that at first. Or secondly, that some of the mystery of God may become somewhat clearer to us. Which is, again, I would think, in line with the belief that we do mature. Eventually, we are able to handle knotty and knotty problems, or we're able to eat meat, as St. Paul said, that it may become somewhat clear, without in the least suggesting that it become purely rational and completely understood. Now, the specific problem that provoked this series this week revolves around the fact that the question of evil has become prominent within the last 5 years, chiefly due to the writings of a man named Richard L. Rubenstein. Now, many of you may not have heard of him, many of you may have, because he has been exposed in the popular press as well as in books that probably you would get only at a better bookstore or a religious one. And Rubenstein's basic thesis starts with this particular that we talked about starting out. And the particular for him as a reformed rabbi, this is his function in life, as an educated one, he has a master's degree from the Hebrew Union College and he has a PhD from Union Seminary where he was Paul Tillich's student. And he, like most of the younger radical theologians, is a former student of Tillich. This man now, exposed by travel to Europe and by visiting the particular scenes where some of these events transpired, Dachau and Auschwitz and others, and reflecting upon this and questioning and talking to people there, not just simply people who had suffered there, but to people who lived in those countries, and again, with no desire just to cast blame on one country or one group of people, but he particularly, as he mentions in his book after Auschwitz, visited, for example, Lutheran and Catholic priests and professors and others who themselves were victimized and jailed and put in these camps and themselves had friends and relatives to die because they resisted this kind of thing. And from these people now, he spins out this very subtle view which is convincing to this point, I think, that there are real problems here that ought to be raised in our mind, and that we cannot just simply dismiss it. If we do so, we may very well be dismissing an opportunity to grow, and we also may be missing one of the last chances theology has, and theology would include the life of all the people of the church, of making the church a possible alternative to other ideologies, or to a life of just meaninglessness for many millions of modern people. It may even be one of the last great opportunities that the church has to demonstrate that religion still is and can be the spirit of Western culture, and that it not die away in some new spirit replace it. Now that problem, as he phrased it, I will just give you a few words from Time Magazine here on deck. It says, "The God of the Hebrew Bible is depicted as a faithful protector of his chosen people. Yet at least 6 million Jews died at the hands of the Nazis. To believe in the God of the Covenant today," concludes Richard Rubinstein, "Jews must affirm this, that the Creator used Adolf Hitler as a rod of his wrath to send the people to the death camp." "I find myself," Dick says, "utterly incapable of believing this. Even in the existentialist sense of a leap of faith, I do not believe now Jews can resurrect the dead God after Auschwitz." As it happens, Rubinstein is not a disaffected atheist, but an ordained rabbi in good standing, chaplain at the University of Pittsburgh. One of the more interesting American Judaistic theologians, he is at least a spiritual cousin to Christianity's Death of God thinkers, who the magazine comments are considerably more enthusiastic about his work than are the Jews, and this is certainly true. And a parenthetical remark, there's probably, as Paul Heaney would remind us, an economic element in everything, and that's certainly true, and there's also a lot of self-seeking in everything. And just as I talked about movies the other night, because I'm doing a book on the movies with somebody else, Nick Rubinstein and I are doing a book on evil now. And the reason why I'm as stupid about this problem as I am is that I really now understand that there is almost nothing we can say to answer this problem. I have nothing but a big blank in my mind whenever I sit down, and I try to each day to write a new group of theses for us to work on this book, which we're calling The Dark Side of Religion, The Other Side of Religion. Rubinstein has an M.A. from Jewish Theological Seminary, a doctorate in psychology of religion. He expressed his disbelief in Judaism's traditional God in his book After Auschwitz in 1966. There he argued that Hitler's Holocaust was deathly proof that the transcendent theistic God of Jewish patriarchal monotheism was no more. You see, whatever you may say about this man or this thesis, he has at least made the proper, not only logical, but moral judgment that a question of this magnitude that involves meaningfulness and meaninglessness involves a doctrine of God. Now, what he may conclude beyond that is certainly moot. But the question which he raises seems to be a proper one, that inevitably questions about what a thing means and the meaningfulness of life, because something of that magnitude involves the meaning of all our lives, is going to involve our doctrine of God, or else we really aren't concerned about a doctrine of God or believing in God or anything else. God's just some idol or phrase that sits out there, very comfortable. It may be that it could be more than that, but we're afraid to bring ourselves into some live relationship with it because we might lose it. Not because we love God, or because he's touched us, but because we would have suffered a loss, and we're not man enough to face that. In other words, it makes a real threat to anyone whose God ultimately is an idol, without in the least denying that it may be a threat in the form of a subtle atheism. But most of the reaction that comes, if we will look at it, stems not so much from the outrage that we might feel at such statements as he makes here, as at the fair, you know, that as Chad Walls put it a long time ago, our God may be just too small to deal with this, or we may be just too small to undergo this crisis. Strongly influenced by Tillich, Rubinstein nonetheless concludes that there is a holy nothingness as a source of all being. This is a kind of a mystical thing, and of course Berma and Meister Eckhart and a good many other mystical thinkers in the Middle Ages, and particularly in the German tradition, have talked about God as a holy nothing or as nothingness. There's nothing atheistic, if I can be facetious about it, in calling God nothingness. Or else all the mystics would have to be read out of the church and all the poets. This holy nothingness, though, is understood in a unique way here by Rubinstein. You might say he's taking one side of the way God as nothingness has been understood, stressing it to the exclusion of the other. This holy nothing is beyond human comprehension, he said. It is beyond categorization. That is, he said, we have got to, for the sake of logic, for the sake of honesty to our experience, and that, remember, he's talking as a Jew, and the Jew's reaction to this Holocaust. I want to keep that in mind. This is why we can use it as an example. Not that we're not involved, but that we are not Jews. In some sense, we can understand that he has a more peculiar or particular line of thought than we would have. This holy nothingness is not to be considered good. That's what he's saying. Because even if you deny, as he denies, that God wills the suffering of men for some good, ultimately, or maybe even for their final betterment in some eternity beyond time, when you deny that, he says this is simply not enough, because if there were still a deity, as he's understood in the Bible, whether he willed it or not, he permitted it. And if he permitted it, then he's not good. There's been a great deal of speculation in theology about what God actively brings about or what he permits, but we both know that if our children were about to take poison or to go in front of an automobile, it would really make little moral difference whether we gave them the shove or opened the bottle for them, or we stood back and permitted them to do it ourselves. Sense of responsibility. I think only a theologian maybe can see the difference. And I think that's because he makes it up. He says the holy nothingness, at least now Dick proceeds on this assumption, is totally beyond human comprehension or categorization. You can't call him good or bad, or call it whatever. He compares its relationship with man to that of the ocean and its waves. Now this is the way Rubinstein says he's not a death of God theologian. He's not an atheist. There's God. But now if I can use this fireplace as an illustration, it's just a vast ocean. Now if you can imagine that full of water, the eternal waters, you know, back in Genesis. It is like an ocean and its waves and its relationship to man. Each wave has its moments in which it is discernible and distinguishable. One of those waves may be you or me, part of this. One of these larger waves may be the Jewish people through 5,000 years of history. Maybe the Christian church throughout its extended history. And yet, it is not eternal. These waves, these ripples on the surface of the ocean that is God, but it too may have its temporal, finite, short-term existence, and then pass back into the water again. Nevertheless, no wave is really separate from the ocean, which is its substantial ground. So there is this constant move and flux. Now this is not an explanation to be sure, it's only an illustration. It's a rather vague one. It's also one that has a long history, and as psychologists could point out to us, has many psychological associations to depths, the sea, to the water in the womb, and many other things. Although he has much in common with today's Christian radicals, Rubinstein is critical of them. He rejects the optimism voiced by Hamilton and Althusser, who argue that God's death makes possible the freedom of man to achieve a spiritual maturity. And this, of course, is the argument some of you may have read in Nietzsche, where he put it this way: I think that if there were a God and he were not I, or I were not he, I couldn't stand it. And he says, a thought of a cosmic peeping Tom looking over my shoulder all the time would make me exceedingly uncomfortable. And when we stop and think the way we tell our children about God sometimes, we're actually trying to drill that exact perception of God into them, and we may wonder why they leave the church when they get old enough to know better, or to feel that it doesn't really matter. Like the Cheshire Cat, you know, whether or not the Cheshire Cat really is still there on the limb and not as immaterial as long as he doesn't meow or say something. Remember the story of the disappearing cat. Now, he doesn't follow this line of reasoning at all. This is not the thing. He is not saying then, as Nietzsche concluded, and as some others today conclude, since God is dead, then all things are permissible for man. You don't have to worry about God looking over your shoulder anymore. He does not conclude this. He says the death of God as a cultural event is undeniable. But this is no reason to dance at the funeral. For man alone is incapable of eliminating tragedy from life. The reason why we shouldn't dance is that all of those hopes and dreams and all of that desire that we poured into God and into our belief in Him now have become our job. It's like the shock that settles in maybe on a young man whose father has died and becomes suddenly apparent he's going to have to be the head of the family and support them. There's no reason to dance at all. Even though in some sense it may elevate a man in his own eyes to think, now I am responsible. That may be a kind of a poor compensation, you know, for two jobs and worry and sweat and labor. Rubinstein believes that religion still has a worthwhile value in an age of atheism. He is convinced that it can help man live in the cold and different cosmos. This is another way he would describe the world. That it is cold and it is indifferent to that. Religion can help offset that by providing a form of fellowship and hope, primarily through satisfying spiritual liturgy and ritual. In other words, very much in the way some of the poets have put it, and many of the theologians today are talking, the community with its solidarity can give us the moral fiber and the support that we need in facing the well-nigh overwhelming, in fact, perhaps overwhelming problems that do confront us. The primary role of religion is priestly, Rubinstein argued. It offers men a ritual and a mythic structure. That is, a mythology, a way of describing these things for us, these deep things which lie too deep for words, because myth is not a false tale. It's the truth that is inexpressible expressed in the poverty of pictorial language. It offers men a ritual and a mythical structure in which the abiding realities of life and death can be shared. Now, I won't go on because it goes on to other books by Dick in there, but simply to say, I think as Langdon Gilkey, who's a very prominent theologian today in this country, a friend of mine and one of Tillich's older students, has put it, that Rubinstein, perhaps more than any other thinker, has really raised the problem that faces Christianity right now in 1968, right today. Gilkey, a man who could have produced any number of works and books, his own particular field was a creator. He wrote about God, the maker of heaven and earth, for example, some years ago. Now he's not producing anything. And to use my poor self for example, I felt that when I was getting my doctorate that the concept of the Holy Spirit was the one that had turned up in history. This is what we need to work on. And then suddenly we're faced with this. It's the first person of the Trinity. It's the doctrine of God itself. It's the whole question of meaning and meaningfulness that is right before us. And we just can't walk around it and write about creation over here, the Holy Spirit over there. unless we just simply want to really be ivy tower type. We really don't love anybody, don't care for anyone, we don't really want to do anything but what we want to do. But there's this big gaping hole in the middle of us, and so instead of building beautiful bridges to nowhere over here, practicing in the middle of the desert, we're over here with popsicle sticks trying to work out a little temporary bridge across this big chasm. And this is the reason for the halting nature of this kind of discourse. This is the reason for the poverty of these books that you read. This is the reason for the non-satisfactory quality, maybe, of the preaching and of the discourse that you have with people who have faced up to the problem of our time, if you will. It may be why the prophets have represented themselves at times as having to do this. There may be more grace in that than in saying a great many things which are just saying a great many things. This is brought up by a humorous story that actually happened one night coming back from a tea or something, a cocktail party or something. Chilik and Gilkey were riding the back of a student's car, and at the party, or whatever it was, everybody was talking about this and that, and there was Chilik there, and nobody was talking about him or his system or anything. He says, "Ach, London, why am I so early on the ice heap?" And of course, he was about 77 then, and Gilkey, who was less than 40, or just about 40, says, "Don't worry about it, Paulus." He says, "I'm already there. I haven't got a chance." And this is what has happened to us, and it's happened to me, and I'm younger than Gilkey, and it's happened to all of us now in this field. And you may look at us and think, oh my gosh, all of the theologians and the theological thinkers and the religious professors and the philosophers have just gone mad, or so left to the enemy. And then you can point to shining examples who are grinding out books, and they're proclaiming in loud voices things. And I would just simply point out here the subtlety now of the problem. I would think the man who is still able to make great protestations about how things still as are as they were is like the youngster who has to learn about the rainfall on Plato's Republic and how many times Lord Byron visited Texas and keep, you know, the confusion of the world under his hat. What I would also say is, unfortunately, myself and many others who are concerned with the problem may be like the teacher in the second poem who are saying, "I hate to tell you this, you know, but there isn't any Santa Claus." Or as much as I would like you to continue believing it, the Easter Bunny doesn't leave those eggs. Now, I will have to say this in honesty and objectivity, both ways participate in this structure of destruction, which is evil. The one, because it will not face whatever it is, its reality. And the second, because it glories in it, not understanding it. And you get what we call debunking. You know, this is so beautiful. And you'll notice that a person who's been a big proclaimer positively on one side, once he faces it, usually ends up as the debunker over here. H.L. Mencken and whoever, one of the big evangelists at the time Mencken was going, probably had more in common than anyone would have expected. Both were proclaiming some kind of gospel. Now, what about evil?
Did you understand you say that he has given up the view which he had in
Oh, he hasn't given it up. He simply believes that nobody will listen to it, you know, and he has presented himself as a friendly critic of radical theology, this since about 1964. You'll notice that he produced a novel, just to answer your question, Chantant's Compound, in which, in a sense, he has contributed to the literature of radical theology, part of which criticizes religion. And in there, he showed that the strictly religious types turned out to be the least humane. You know, I know you've read the novel. That you will notice that his theological output has been restricted to articles, and these in rather secluded places like theological bulletins. And they have usually been critical and yet sympathetic dialogues with people like Rubenstein, for example, and Alcott, whom he knows very well. No, he hasn't. In a sense, Gilkey remains closer to neo-orthodoxy, perhaps, than most men his age, because he is on the youngest side for an established theologian. But you don't see him turning out the kind of things that you would expect. Just to make an illustration, at 45, say, he's approximately that. In our last theological generation, men had 6, 7, 8 books up, and they were already known, you know, this way. And there's no question about Gilkey's competence, the ability to do it, but the honesty of the man prevents him from doing it. Now, this may be a dishonest representation of him, but this is the way I sense him, and I've lived with him for a number of years, and I would sense him this way. His teaching now, he's very good, and he continues to teach the traditional approach, I would say the New Orthodox tradition, but he will not force his views or even his apprehension of this problem on his students. In fact, he is the most free professor for a dissertation that I could imagine. And yet he does bring out, after, for example, he lectures over Calvin's Institutes, you know, and things of this nature, and Luther's theological work and so forth. He'll always, at the end, leave it with these problems now face us and so forth. That he has become a radical himself is not true. No, he is not. Maybe that's why he's retreated to the novel. Maybe we'll have a great novel without him. And I would think that in him, we might have a symbol of our time where the theologians are becoming philosophers or poets, if they can, and so forth, receding away from this problem. Yes, sir.
I'm sure I've missed you someplace.
I left it out probably.
Rubenstein in some place. Yes. They might be saying this, what I heard, and I'm sure it's her, or else I wouldn't be asking about it. Apparently, I'll just say it simply, and then you can straighten it out for me. Rubenstein seems to be saying, God is not there, not in control, because people get hurt. 6 million Jews are killed. Therefore, I must either say he's not good because all of these in charge, he's just permitting it to happen.
In the traditional sense, yeah.
Certainly, he cannot mean that. Freedom is not the goal of the good. He must accept that notion of perhaps. Freedom necessarily involves the capacity to exercise dominion and destroy. And therefore, the very act of God of releasing man to be man, an exercise of the dominion that God gave us, and that freedom is the ultimate good which can result in perversion. Now, how does Rubenstein get out of that box?
Well, it isn't a box. Because, of course, as a Jew, and the Jews are much closer to Protestants than Protestants are to the traditional Catholic position on this matter of freedom, as perhaps most of us know, he realizes, you know, man would be an automaton under, now to go back and use the traditional language, man would just be a robot if he were only able to elect whatever it is that we want to decide as goodness. And the creation fall story illustrates this. But it isn't this question of human freedom. Fairly obviously, some men who had, for either political and economic or because of psychological reasons, elected that the Jews were going to be eliminated, did this in their freedom. And fairly obviously, too, which Rubenstein will face up to, and which I think there has to be faced up from the Jewish side, many Jewish people use their freedom not to resist or not to face the enormity of what was facing them, perhaps. Not that many did not resist, but that most were like sheep. Now, there was freedom involved, but it isn't at this point that he questions it. That's explanatory of how things happen. And at this point, we have been able many times to disguise a more basic issue. That's a question of anthropology, of human freedom, limited as we recognize it is, and yet really be this question of being able to make a mistake, to do wrong. St. Augustine brought up.
To make a mistake.
To make a mistake at a minimum. At a minimum, yeah.
As soon as you said do wrong, that's something else.
Well, but at a minimum, to be able to make a mistake, yeah.
Just wrong.
Okay. But now, the problem is larger than that. The problem then involves the providence of God, of which human nature, anthropology, which means study of human nature, and then freedom and determinism are only subsets, they're only parts of time. And the providence of God doctrine, again, in very simple terms, is that in some way, and then this is very traditional, very mythical language, in some way God foresees and senses what the drift of history will be. So that regardless of the determinations of individual men in the freedom which they have, the whole pattern ultimately tends towards his purposes. To put it again in a phrase which is more from a hymn than from a theology, God uses individual evil things in the aggregate to tend towards good.
Right.
All right, this means then that in some sense, you might say, and this is why you get this whole business of what is being willed and what is being permitted about evil. Now, that doctrine of providence, which is a larger explanatory element than the smaller one of freedom, is what he is calling in question, instead of what Rubenstein is calling in question. And I would say many Protestant thinkers too are calling
it. Isn't that inherently because he has not decided what good is?
No, I don't think so.
I can't say that it isn't good unless he's made a determination about it.
Well, let's say this. We may not know what a specific thing is, but we may know what it isn't.
It isn't functional.
No, okay, it isn't
functional. You can't say it isn't good.
Let me use a better illustration. Let's say we have a mineral that's new to our experience and our science, and we don't know what it is, but by giving the various tests, which a laboratory textbook might very well include, or a man capable of doing these tests would know by heart, we can determine, well, it isn't this, and it isn't that, and it isn't that. He is saying this. This experience, and of course, again, we want to say we have a particular example before us. He's using this particular question of the 6 million Jews, and he's looking at it as a Jew. So we want to be objective as we can without making a mistake of saying, well, you know, that's really Dick's problem, and that's my friend who's a Jew problem. Of course, it's all of our problem, but we'll lay it out here just for a moment, the abstract. He is saying this, and I don't know that he would say these words, but I think from knowing him and from reading his book, I would say it would be something like this. I don't know what good is, but I know it isn't that. I don't know what the doctrine of providence may mean, but, and I believe I would be exactly correct out of this interpretation, I do know whatever the doctrine of providence may mean, it cannot mean that this is a good thing, either in the immediate or in the long-term consequences. And of course, on that point, he has been attacked more by Jewish theologians than anyone else, who have gone on to show that, you know, they don't like it any more than he does. But they have said, well, the upshot was this, the establishment of the city of Jerusalem, you know, in the new state of Israel and so forth. He has been very much attacked and so forth. But now, his position is this, and I would have to say this, why now is this important? It's obviously important theologically, that is from the logic of trying to understand our life under the aegis of our faith and recognizing the problem when we see it. But I think it has a wider utility than that. And that is because what Rubenstein is saying specifically as a Jewish man and as a man who knows philosophy and theology and knows the particular event very well, he is saying, no, I don't know what it is, and I don't know what good is, but I know that's not good. And in this, he is joined by just innumerable men in the modern world going out this way. He's joined by
the world, that is, but either an irrational statement,
yeah,
or else an expression of a new creed.
Well, I would have to say that in his case, it's probably a new creed is developing. You can see this when he starts talking about the holy nothingness and so forth. You're quite right in using the word irrational because of the existentialist.
No, John, I mean, if I say I haven't been thinking about what a witness is, but what you've got there isn't one.
Yeah, in other words, it's either unexplainable in any sense, or else you've got to have a new religion. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that you must create a standard by which you're making a determination.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've done that, you have presupposed that you know what all the truth is.
No,
I've been doing that. He's gotten no further than Exodus, and he's missed the point of parable. You know.
The point of what?
Parable.
Parable.
The concept of redemptive God spelling out in parable by the Exodus.
Experience.
And he's gotten no further than saying if God doesn't provide for him, mm-hmm. if he doesn't keep the Nazi off my back, he's an evil God.
No, I think you may be exactly right. And yet, in one sense, but again, I would certainly deny that that was ultimately a view that could be held by a Jew or Christian. That it is held and has been held, I wouldn't deny. Because I sense this, and everywhere I look, the people that I talk to, younger people, the writings that move me seem to sense this too, that if indeed there is a providence and it spells out its terms or it works its will, and this is one of the terms in it, then I want nothing to do with such a providence.
Haven't you made providence mean paternalism?
No, not in the least.
Be protected.
No, not in the least. But it seems to me you have to judge a thing by its effects, don't you? This can hardly be called a good under any term.
Well, of course, I can't judge. That's what John has no point. This is beyond the rational judgment machine of God. I can judge nothing unless I've got a model.
Well, I think that we have a built-in model for this one, and that's our own lives.
No, sir, we can go.
Oh yeah, we have a built-in model, I think, when it comes down to massacre and murder.
This is the people's problem. And this is why Rubenstein is perfectly correct when he says that religion can help man survive in a cold and indifferent cosmos. This is a perfectly Jewish, absolutely correct statement for him to make. Because obviously God gave man the law as a mechanism for survival in a hostile environment.
I can see you're exactly correct there.
Right. But he's completely missed the end of the Old Testament, and he has no comprehension, apparently, of what's written there. That is to go beyond the place where you make models and judge. This is part of the basic error that we get when we start talking about God and judgments about good, as if we could manufacture good by our judgment.
All right, let me buy into your argument now and simply say that aren't you assuming then that all questions about ultimate justification in terms of God will have to be left aside too?
By this in my terminology.
Because I really could buy into what you're saying. I think he could, although he might, you know, be very uncomfortable with it. But what you're ultimately saying is we have to drop this business about
trying to prove God.
Trying to prove that there's a God,
sure.
Or dealing
sure.
with God.
Sure. But
that's what I meant the other day about the truncation that comes in when we do use this kind of language. Now, I'm not trying to refute you.
Yeah, no,
it simply illustrates
it. It's simply so we understand you. It seems to me you've got to run if you want to run this way. And if I were to say, as the director, or something to say, that God's dead in this context, then I must at the same time say evil is dead.
Wow.
Death and evil. It's inevitable. One goes with, as my friend Bill Douglas said, the Supreme Court, Dale goes with a high. He's got to be that, bro. And if evil is dead, well, I like to find out where one enlists to rejoice. Because he's done a pretty good job of establishing there.
Yeah, he doesn't go that far now. That's enough. Some of the Christian so-called atheists do go that far, rejoicing. But he doesn't go this far. In other words, his idea of ritual, and it's very interesting that when he illustrates this in a talk or something, he always talks about the, I've forgotten the Jewish terms, but the mass for the dead, you know, and the funeral, and the comfort it comes from expressing emotion or something. He doesn't talk about weddings and things of this nature. He doesn't rejoice. It isn't something to dance about, it is a thing. That's a pretty good description. Yeah.
Must one assume, as you assumed a few minutes ago, that God's good is man's good? I'm thinking of the argument that Jonathan Edwards used to explain the problem of evil, and that is that suffering of a child may be bad for the child, but may be good for God. That is, that man exists not for his own salvation, not for his own happiness,
but for God's glory.
But for God's glory.
Who was that told that story here the other day? Maybe it was last week before some of you came in. You know, that's one of the standard questions and answers in the Reformed tradition.
Yeah.
Are you willing to be condemned to hell for the greater glory of God? And they said they asked a young Presbyterian minister to be this synodical committee. He says, I sure am. I'm willing for the whole committee to go to hell. But now, aside from the facetiousness of it, I would have to say that there is, when you get into this, how could we answer? I'd have to agree with him here, and I mean, and even on the metaphysical basis, really, how can we answer except by assertions of faith, something that we simply are going to have to assume, at least as far as we talk human, about God's good and man's good. But I would say this. In the Christian tradition, we do have some empirical evidence. As shaky as it might be, it's rather all persuasive, I would think, at least for many of us, and that is Jesus. And some of the things he does, and some of the things that are reported that he said. And when you begin this, I think Luther, unsystematic, unphilosophical, untheological as he was, sensed these things in this way that he had. He says, don't begin with the high things of God. He says, begin down here in the manger with the child. Begin with the man on the cross. And I think now, you know, when we looking now in our tradition, which has primarily in it this man, Jesus Christ, then it becomes exceedingly difficult, not just an impossible philosophical problem, but a really religious problem about talking about God's good and man's good being different. It becomes very different. And of course, Jonathan Edwards and all of the high nobility, apparently, of these writings about willingness to suffer and so forth, information, they take on a vastly different connotation.
What about, I haven't read much of anything. I've read quite a bit of the Bible.
You're ahead of the game, I would say.
Anyway, what about, in Job you get the idea, well, Job, he wrestles more with this and then wrestle with this, and then Job finally gives up. Who am I to know what God's plan or anything? He just satisfied that God is God, and what happens. Then it goes, what about Jeremiah, Daniel, and Lamentations, Revelations, where you seem to have this idea where men may gradually turn away from God and keep turning away, and God seems to give them up to their immorality in themselves.
And then
each nation has to drink a cup of wrath, which is war, pestilence, and famine. And it seems like through this war, pestilence, famine, man has to turn back to God and look to Him. I've heard it expressed as this is being God's, this wrath concept of being God's love in action, like a father disciplining a child for his betterment.
Yeah, and of course this is quite traditional, and you express it fairly well. On the Book of Job, I can't answer you because the experts on the Book of Job can't answer their own questions there. One of the things that both the Jewish and the Christian theologians deal with, and you quite properly introduce Job into a discussion like this, because Job, in a sense, comes as close in the Hebrew and Christian tradition as any other writing to what the Greeks call theodicy, that is, a justification of God's way to man, that is, trying to talk about God's good and man's good, and the educational benefits, if you will, from God's view of human history and these sort of things. But now, as we know, there are many, many different endings to the Book of Job. This book gave the people who had it and passed it down to us the problems that it gives to us, even with the endings that they've added on to it. And one section that I've forgotten, it's been many years since I've studied Job or anything, but I do recall, and I've read even recently, where Christian and Jewish thinkers on it relatively agree about this, where Job just faces up to the man, so to speak, you know, boy, this is not the humble section. You know, this is just wrong. And the three comforters, you know, all of Job, that's because you're stiff-necked. That's because you're sinful. You know, Job, think that, didn't you? Maybe cheat just a little bit. Ever been unfaithful to your wife? And over here, you know, something. Maybe you just don't understand the great plan. You get all these Job's comforters and everything. And in that situation there, the voice of God is represented as being said by the poet who produced it. Something of this effect. You comforters are missing the point. Job is right down on it. You know? He's really right down on it. And he's wrestling with God. Somebody talked the other day about Jacob wasn't it, you know, wrestling with the angels. So he's really wrestling with you're right down on it, if you will. So that at least at that point, you know, one of the poets or one of the teachers who contributed to this document about Job affirmed, you know, maybe that's as much as we can say. Job was right to raise the question, not to explain it too simply. But now I would have to go on and say this. Two. And in some ways it's an individual argument, and yet it's not any one individual. It's from the point of view of the human person, or you might say it's a temporal argument from the point of view of times. Maybe in the long run of the human race, evil that befalls men, for example, the bubonic plague, the 100 Years' War, the 30 Years' War, the century of total war, the Holocaust of the Jewish people, Vietnam. Maybe in some utterly detached, artificial, non-real, we can't even visualize it manner, these things might contribute to whatever good is. But the question remains, what about the individual? And what about the time itself? That suffered when the rats overran the earth. That suffered under the ignorance that preached the children's crusade. That suffered in the gas chamber. That suffered under the napalm now. And can you, and this is the real problem, I think, the problem is a cement that holds parts of the religious tradition together, and the legal tradition, and all of the human tradition. The cement is, can you hold this, which is essentially a doctrine of meaningfulness, with this, that love ultimately is the one really religious and ethical criteria. Love for all men, of all kinds, at all times, in all places. Can you hold them together? And that's where it comes in. And it seems to me that Jesus, although we understand Jesus as the Christ, maybe sometimes to the exclusion of his humanity, which would be wrong, just as understanding his humanity to the exclusion of his reference to divinity and to spirituality would be wrong. But it seems to me that what he stressed about Jesus was not, about God rather, was not some overarching plan or anything, but God is Father, and God is love. And it's difficult to speak. It's difficult, although we normally explain Jesus to ourselves, and we put him in this overall plan, you know, he suffered, you know, and everything like that. And I sometimes have said it's homiletics, not theology, but it's why we're so easily able to jump from the Sunday before Easter to Easter and just read all obviate good Friday. What about Jesus? Hanging on that cross, you see. Yeah.
Is this illustration you use about the 50 million Jews being killed, is that an illustration that he used?
That Rubenstein used, yeah. And of course, you know, it's fairly prominent. Yeah,
yeah. Would he also use an illustration of the death of one person?
I'm sure that he probably would, although the problem that he picked up was the first one.
Yeah, if he wouldn't, it would seem to me that all of his conclusions just fall aside.
Because they're a question of quantity.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah,
what if he's saying that, and if he used the death of one person in a war or an automobile accident, I suppose he might even go as far as the death of a person as a result of a disease.
Yes, and
or
of course
having
that's a
disease.
That's ultimately got to be part of it.
Of being susceptible to a disease.
I have to go with you.
All the way back to the point where you have any type of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
What
and of course,
saying,
the problem
is 6 million Jews getting killed at one time in a short period of time. There was nothingness, there was no God, whatever he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have problems. Some of them are great, some of them are small.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have problems, or burdens, or what you want to use, this food I'm talking about, hemp couldn't be a very good diet for it.
Exactly, but don't you see that although we may be able to suffer from a smaller qualitative problem, and of course the problem of suffering, like the problem of sin, are included in under this general thing, the problem of evil, and you're perfectly right. You know, it doesn't hold for one least part, it's not going to hold for all. And this may be exactly a good way of trying to come to some reasonable solution of it, if it has one. But think about this first before we dissolve it away. It's fairly obvious we all have problems. Each one of us have built-in weaknesses and so forth, and we're susceptible, and we die. But that something large may be necessary, or it may be that it functions in this way as calling our attention to something. It's like when we were in college, you know, we were always horsing around and a lot of big football player types around. Sometimes it's all up and smacking on the side of the head with your fist. Well, an ordinary person would knock down, doesn't even faze them. And you say, why'd you do that? You say, well, you know, he's a good guy, but you've got to get his attention before you can talk to him. Pretty obviously, the Holocaust of the Jews is just, well, I would say, beyond all human comprehension and just horrible. Now, that's just my personal confession. But yet there are other things in history equally beyond comprehension and horrible. The bubonic plagues, it seems to me, even more. The 100 years war, the 30 years war, the wars of religion, you know, even more so because of the Crusades. I can't think of anything more evil in this irrational, incomprehensible sense, at least in the Children's Crusade, or even all of the Crusades, if you take them. But now, it may be that they're just like that fist on the size of a bull's head, you know, to get your attention. We let slip by, just as we may lose $5 every month, you know, playing poker or something, and suddenly, you know, we've got a little bit of gambling streak in us, and we lose $1,500. Put the cards away. I can't afford that kind of thing. You know, I've got your attention.
Is
so that we recognize that? What's been the case all along.
Is he not saying that God is, you as I am, as individuals, as a society, God is absent from us, rather than totally absent? Because
he's saying that, yes.
That, God
yes.
is absent from us.
Yes, he said.
And we do these things. I can understand that. But say God is totally absent, or God is dead, as some people put, but it's an assertion or conclusion that almost anybody can make without the basis. You know?
Yeah, well,
if
he is
saying God doesn't dwell with us,
mm-hmm.
and I say, well, how do you prove it? Then he talks about these wars, and all these things. I can understand that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But now he does make one further step, which may you wouldn't go along with. And you know, I see perfectly, and I think you're perfectly right in your reasoning. But he goes on to say, not only is God absent from us, because I suppose any Christian or Jewish religiously oriented person would say this. In fact, we get this every Sunday in the sermon, don't we? And usually, if it's any kind of preaching at all, it's going to try to lay it on us and point us where, you know, we're not living in remembrance of God or something,
it.
We haven't accepted it or something. But he goes on to make a further statement, which isn't as far as the one that you said, you know, God's dead, which some have said.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, well, we were mistaken about the character of God. I would think this would be plain language.
Yeah.
And then he goes to say, God really is ultimately indifferent. Now, here is where his thought ties in. This is what he says. It's the open.
That's wild statement.
Yeah, but is it wild, or can it stand up to the kind of proof that he's asking for?
I think it's totally irrational, John. It's the very fact
it may be irrational, but is it without proof?
Look, the fact that I permit my child to grow up means neither that I am not with him, nor that I don't love him. It may be that I stand immediately behind him, the thing that gives him the strength to make a decision. Know the old man there, so let him do what you got to do, you got to do. The son is assured of my love precisely because I am willing to let him do that.
Yeah, but that sounds like that sounds very helpful and very fine. And I don't mean to say anything derogatory against it, but it sounds like the helpful best description of the relation of the Christian to God too, which is what you intend. That is not an explanation that is given for these kinds of things. Let me ask you how far that goes.
Christian theology is pretty rare commodity.
Oh, I'm sure that that's true too. Yeah, and that's one of the very large problems that we have to face, I think, is that we aren't able to sit down and talk about these untalkaboutable things, not only because they stretch beyond what we know, but because so few people are equipped even to begin at the borders of it, including myself, to talk about it. There's been there's very little theology. But now let me ask you about this. Of course, a human father isn't God. We know that that's an analogy to God, and we wouldn't expect the same. But yet, I keep coming back to this, because now I'm a Christian. Now, that makes me any better, but not a Jew. There's something added to a Christian. He's a Jew plus Christ, maybe. I don't know whether that's a good description, but
first time I heard it.
And for me, as a Jew plus Christ, I can't talk about anything else but Jesus. Maybe that's what makes a Lutheran. A Lutheran is a Christian who, at best, ought to not be one that speaks with a Scandinavian accent or has a German name or goes around saying the mighty fortress is our God in the shower or a lot of the other stereotypes that we get across, but be one that has narrowed down Christianity to really what it is, Christ. Because, you know, we could really let everything else go. Believe it or not, you can have church without the red book, you know, or anything like that. Now, in that way, then I have to say that the analogy between your helpful approach to your son and God's approach to you and your son and me and other people will only be an analogy. And the God concept is a lot bigger than the Father concept. But yet, the God concept really can't contradict some of the more essential things because of what we know about this man, Jesus, about love. And so this question immediately arises. You're standing behind your son and you're letting him make his mistakes and so forth. But what if he asked for bread? You don't give him a stone, Jesus said. But now, what if he's about to get in a killing situation? What now is your response, you see? And I'm not pressing you for it. There are many things, and we can talk about human freedom, and we have to. Ultimately, that is involved in the question of evil and good, more than even what their definitions are. Because I would think human personality, human freedom is because we are men, and that's the way we see the universe, rather than this nature.